in the several hundred years after the time of the Buddha, as Buddhism was spreading vastly as an evangelical religion in the Indian subcontinent and was coming into contact with all these other traditions within India and the surrounding areas. So it was in dialogue with Vedanta and Advaita Vedanta, non-dualism, different schools of devotional practice, the Vaishnava schools later on with the tantric schools, Shaiva, Tantra, particularly. In all these encounters, one of the themes that was sometimes said about Buddhism as a kind of put-down, so I'm here to reclaim the put-down, was that Buddhism was only a system of ethical practice. And this might be odd for us to think about in contemporary Western culture being in contact with Buddhism, because a lot of folks here would say, oh, Buddhism, that's the meditation practice. Meditation is the thing that has most arrived in North America, for instance, as the heart of Buddhism. But in what we might call the early Middle Ages, if you asked a random person on the streets of Delhi, and of course I have no idea what they would say, certainly not this, but I'm going to project that they might say, based on some texts that are written down, oh, Buddhism, that's the ethical religion. And what they meant by that, in a way, is that the aspect of Buddhist practice that had been very widely emphasized and really had come to be thought of as the center of the practice was the practice of observing the ethical precepts. So the five lay precepts that we chant at the beginning of each time we meet here, the trainings to not take life, to not take that which isn't offered to us, or not to steal, the training to either express our sexual energy wisely for lay people, or if we were monastics, to maintain celibacy, to use speech wisely by telling the truth, to speaking kindly, and by not misusing intoxicants, or in some interpretations, not using any kind of intoxicant at all. And these trainings, collectively called sila, or virtue, ethics, lately I've been wanting to use the old word morality, partly because no one wants to use it. It's like moral. So I kind of want to reclaim it. Moral is great. But these trainings came to be thought of as the centerpiece of the practice. And I want to propose, as we start the year, in a certain way, like I want to go back all the way to the beginning of the gradual path, it's called in Buddhism, where the path toward liberation from suffering, toward uprooting greed, hatred, and delusion, is described again and again in the discourses as a gradual path that builds layer upon layer toward this quite incredible fruition, right? The emptying out of the self, the dissolving of karma, the seeing of rebirth, the uprooting of the very, very ancient grained tendencies toward constriction and clutching and fear, confusion, dullness. We talk a lot about that aspect, the deep liberation aspect. And if we respect the framework of the gradual path, then it behooves us to again and again turn back to the beginning. So the beginning of that path is described in some places as the ethical precepts. In other places, it's described as there being even a foundation to that which is giving, dana, the practice of generosity, as really the foundation. And in many of the discourses, the Buddha will give a talk to a layperson who comes, who is not yet a believer, who doesn't yet hasn't taken refuge, doesn't yet feel committed to the path. And the Buddha does not teach complicated metaphysics to these people, ever. He doesn't, somebody comes in off the street, all sorts of people would come to visit the Buddha. And these kind of talks, the gradual teachings, were very often given to people like, you know, there's a text where like a kind of party kid comes in and he's like, well, you know, me and my friends, we were mostly just hanging out. They said you were cool. We came to check you out. You know, what you got? And the Buddha doesn't start with, you know, dissolve the sense of yourself into profound emptiness. The Buddha starts with, it's important to be generous and to act wisely. And goes from there. And kings come in, princes come in, people from many different walks of life come in, deities show up and get this teaching. And in various ways, again and again, you know, the medieval stereotype, oh, Buddhism, that's the ethical, it's actually correct in a certain way. There's a huge amount of emphasis given to acting in a wise and restrained way in the world, in the texts. So why would that be? Why is giving and ethical action, I'll talk mostly about ethical action today, why is ethical action the foundation of further cultivation? We can think about this as not ethical action being a kind of the kindergarten practice, like, oh, you learn your basic letters, and then you build up to, you know, complex literature from there. But more like, no, that's exactly the metaphor, right? Complex literature is full of letters. You never let go of reading A, B, C, and D. You just build on that in this vast way. It never disappears. So here's what ethics actually is from a whole path perspective. One way of thinking about it. The Buddha starts off his search afraid of death and loss. And as he searches, what he finds is the disciplines that allow him to concentrate the mind, to really, really get still and see very clearly. And what he does with that concentrated mind is he looks at his past. He looks at all the places he's lived and all the kind of families he's been part of, everything he's done, and he looks at birth and death over and over and over. He looks at his ancestry in a certain way we can think about. And he says, you know, there I was doing this, and there I was doing this, and I was born here and died there, I ate this, I did those things. He looks at his class, his social standing. What's he doing? Then he looks at everybody else, and he says, oh, this is how it works. People experience the results of their actions, you know? That like, oh, you know, this family has, you know, caused a lot of harm. Oh, these people are miserable. It's a direct equation. At one point, this king comes to see the Buddha. He's a supporter. And the Buddha gives him this gradual path teaching. And at the end of this whole, like, incredible teaching, beautiful scripture, it's one of those sort of majestic discourses, the king says, thank you, blessed one, I love it, gotta go, lots to do. And the Buddha says this standard thing he says whenever anyone does that. He says, now is the time, great king, to do as you see fit. So he says, do what you like, man. You know. And when the king leaves, the Buddha says to the assembled monastics, monks, if that king had not killed his father to become king, his heart would be clear enough to have become liberated while I spoke. My discourse would have touched him that deeply had his karma, had his path been clear of ethical misconduct. But because he killed his father, his lineage, we might say, is wounded in such a way that he can't actually receive the teachings. And it's clear that there's a kind of precision in the Buddha's description. There's great compassion, but it's not an emotional description. He's really describing the function of karma in a very direct way. He said, that's what this person did, and this is the result. Period. And so the Buddha looks at his own ancestry, he looks at other people, he looks at how cause and effect happens, and he understands it. And what he understands at its heart is that actions bear fruit in line with their harmfulness or non-harmfulness. What he proposes is that the thermodynamics, as it were, of the universe are intrinsically moral. In the same way that we could say in Newtonian dynamics, you know, if I roll, my three-year-old got a croquet set from his aunt for Christmas, so we have croquet balls around the house, nice, heavy. If I rolled a croquet ball across the circle here to my friend, it would, assuming that the wood floor is relatively flat and not bumpy and not sticky and any number of things, the conditions, we expect that ball will roll more or less straight across the room, right? Basic dynamics, and you know that's going to happen, mostly, right? I put some energy in, there's a trajectory, it goes that way. The proposal that the Buddha makes is that where you turn up, and by you, right, hashtag not self, by you we mean you, your family, your culture, etc., all the circles that you call you, your community, where you turn up is based on the direction of force in your system. And that direction of force is moral. If you cause harm, that's force. That's the force that compels you in a certain direction, right? And again, you doesn't mean just your body, as if you were somehow separate. The insight that we talk on a lot, the vast metaphysical insight into not-self, is not separate from the basic foundational step of ethics in any way. Right? When I lately ask myself, why am I suffering in this particular way? One of the things that I am working on right now is my adoption, my having been adopted at birth. And it's a great example of this thing that folks will bring up as a sticking point with the teaching on karma that says that your actions determine your rebirth, your conditions, basically, the results. You know, we might say, what did I, this child, adopted at birth, like the very first day of my life, I went home with other people, right? What did that child do to deserve that rupture from his parents, his birth parents? And from a Christian perspective that I grew up in, from the perspective that thinks of me as a unique individual, eternally separate, eternally individual soul, that's a terrible proposition. Right? Because that child didn't do anything to deserve that. That's awful to say that. But the rub comes when we recognize that karma doesn't mean you as in this body, because that was always subject to confusion. We might say, what happened in the past to lead to the result of this child being adopted at birth and bearing then the wounds of that rupture? My birth dad was Puerto Rican, Navy, Bronx, Pentecostal, poor. My birth mom was middle class Episcopal white, Peoria, Illinois. One narrative for why I was adopted at birth is that there was no framework for a mixed race, mixed class marriage in 1970 in America. There was no clear pathway for those two kids to stay together and raise a child in a wholesome way. Who did that? And where did that karma come from? Part of how we want to investigate karma is to get out of the obsessive fixation on the separate individual. I was adopted at birth because racism, because classism, because America, because colonialism, because the Spanish invaded Puerto Rico, because the Puerto Ricans ended up in the Bronx, because a kid stabbed my birth dad's best friend in front of him in the Bronx. Like, wherever you take the story, it's bigger than me. But it's also not separate from me. I found out when I was 35 that my adoptive father's father, my adoptive grandfather on my father's side, was Jewish. Never knew. I was raised Catholic, he was Catholic, everybody was Catholic. Finally, I find out in my late 30s that he converted, but that my dad actually heard Yiddish in the home growing up. I went home to my dad. I was like, "Dad, Jewish?" He was like, "Oh, yeah." I said, "You never said anything." He said, "Oh, it never occurred to me." I was like, "Dude, Jewish, Jewish." You know, it is not a non-mattering identity in this world. And he was like, "Oh, yeah, you know, I don't know. I kind of thought you knew." It's great, right? Because identity is actually that flimsy in a funny, challenging way. It's also not. And so the foundation of the path being ethics says something like this. Your individual actions matter. They affect the people around you. They affect you. They will determine the rest of your life. If you do a really bad action, and notice that the precepts are not subtle. They're like, don't kill people. Don't sleep with the wrong people. Don't lie. Like, really, it's big stuff. It's not like, you know, it's not like, don't, you know, fall prey to the subtle fluctuations of complex interpersonal relationships such that things are slightly imperfect with emotions. That's not the precepts. That's your psychology in different ways. That's community and relationship. The precepts are concrete. You kill people, you will experience the results. But it also means that if your family has killed people, you are experiencing the results. If your community at large has killed people, you experience the results. There's a movement right now that many of you are very familiar with. I was at an event this week, a kind of activist community celebration put on by folks called Thrive East Bay, good crew, fun music. Rupa and the April Fishes played and sang, the Thrive Choir sang, a wholesome gathering. And they did something that happens very, very often in some circles that I run in now, which is which was what is sometimes called a land acknowledgement. To say, you know, as we begin, we want to acknowledge that we are on Ohlone land here. And folks mentioned some of the organizations that are working to raise money to bring East Bay land back into the hands of Ohlone people. And it's beautiful as both you know, a practice and a kind of reparations and a gesture and a waking up to history. And one of the ways we might understand this is to say, you know, you didn't, you know, like colonize California and commit genocide, but and who knows who you are, right? It might not even be that we say, like, your people did. I'm English, Puerto Rican through the Spanish side, but with a little bit of African in there, so some of my people did this. So then I do that land acknowledgement, and part of what I'm saying is I, broadly speaking, caused this harm. How can I repair it? And if we do this, if we take this practice all the way, it both starts and ends with individual action. Like, what do you do? But it becomes, what can you do about what your family does? And what can you do about what your community does? What can your community do about what our entire culture does? And at each level of this, there's a kind of self that does actions. My family did some actions. My community has done actions. My culture certainly has done actions. And when I go out in this list, I end up at what I call just call ecosystem, and you could say cosmos or whatever for it. But that's a level that's mysterious. My toddler got a book from the library a little bit ago called Ape, which is gorgeous, and I fully recommend it. Incredible pencil drawings of the five great apes. And really detailed, like faces and gestures. It's a beautifully drawn book with nice typography, you know, to boot, which really, really helps. And the book starts off and says, there are five kinds of great apes. Four of them are quite rare. Here they are. And it tells you about orangutans, chimpanzees, bonobos, and gorillas. It's these stunning pictures. And it says, you know, and the orangutans live in this little tiny place over here in Borneo, and the chimps live in this little tiny place in Africa, and the, you know, gorillas live in this little tiny place in Africa. And at the end of the book it says, oh, and there's a fifth great ape. It's called humans, and you're everywhere. And in the end it says, essentially, hey humans, what's up? How come you have, you know, how come you are behaving a bit like, as they say in The Matrix, a virus taking over every square inch of the planet? What if the humans is a kind of self that has done an action, and that action is harmful in part? Also beautiful. Can I really separate the destruction of the entire planet from the, just to speak personally, the sonatas and partitas for solo violin of J.S. Bach? Some of the most stunning soul-moving music I have ever heard. Can I separate that from colonialism? Can I separate that from the arc of planetary destruction? Can't. Right? You pull on any thread in this thing and the whole thing vibrates. So what of that self, the human self, that took over the whole thing? And could that self, that individual, that being, the old word was Gaia, to include the humans and the whole planet as a self, could that being have an ethical trajectory? And could that being awaken? And so then the gradual path starts with ethics, and it says, mind your actions. And you mind your actions essentially by being a renunciate, by stopping doing things that are harmful. That's the main thing. And then as you mature in that, the stopping becomes cultivating. You stop taking life and you start caring for. You stop taking resources and you start giving with generosity, etc. And so ethics is both the moment-to-moment, flicker-of-mind moment to flicker-of-mind moment practice, and it's the basis of meditation. As in, oh, the mind is wandering into a hateful or fearful thought. Could I be kinder? Can I be more ethical with myself? Right? Don't lie to yourself. Don't hurt yourself. Which means discipline the mind. And that goes all the way to the very end of the shattering of the sense of the separate self. Because if I mind my actions and I care for the future by tending the unfolding karma that I'm participating in, the proposal in this tradition is that that has a clear trajectory, and that trajectory, like the trajectory of the ball, if it is not given further force, is towards stillness. That action with force that causes harm settles, and as that settles, the action that remains is radiant and beneficent and tends to be less directional. And so the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, the saints of this tradition, act for good, but they do so in this kind of radiant way. Even when they're intervening in something specific, they do it with a very different mind. And this gets really developed in the Mahayana traditions, that engagement happens from a different place. It still happens, but it happens from a place, basically, where you've already forgotten the separate self. You let go of the separate self, anger and fear and constriction fall away. If you forget the separate family, rivalry falls away, if you forget the separate community, that means that there's been enough healing to feel safe. Violence falls away. And bit by bit, out through the layers, there's an abandoning of harm and a settling into a kind of radiant, loving stillness. So ethics becomes, is not actually just the foundation of the path in any simplistic way. It is, as is said again and again, it is in fact the whole path. The whole path is tending our actions and tending them in the direction of kindness and goodness and restraint from the long karma of causing harm. And I think that's what no further rebirths means. Nobody goes anywhere. But what would happen if my entire self, body, family, community, culture, race, species, planet, stopped causing harm? What would that be like? Some space for thoughts and reflections.
Talked about your own wrestling with your own karmic, history and destiny, and sort of like, how did this happen, and why were you taken from your that separation from your birth parents? So you could be you right here at this moment teaching us. That was all of that came into making you who you are at this very moment.
Yeah.
So that was why. It wasn't like cleaning up some bad thing you did in your past life or some kind of that it was. It's sort of because then I think there's this paradox of trying to dissolving this sense of separate self, which also means sort of dissolving this notion that I have a particular good karma or bad karma, that thing is good, my life is good or my life is bad, or I have to atone for my grandfather who was a slave owner, my great-grandfather who was a slave owner, or I have to benefit because I'm carrying grief or something, and that, so it's a sort of a paradox, trying to like understand my karma, why was I born into my family with my depressed mother or whatever, and also, but then there's only this whole sense of me. It's as some kind of separate thing.
As long as there's a sense of me, the paradox is present.
Right.
And it's like, oh, I don't want to be obligated to somehow clean up my ancestors' bad actions. What I want to be is so connected to the stream of life that I wouldn't want to do otherwise. Why would I want to carry forward a poisonous gift from the past
and pass it on to generations?
Absolutely. I have a friend who was the son of an abusive father, who was himself the son of an abusive father, who was himself the son of an abusive father. A long line of physically violent drunks and who beat their children. And my friend was doing a kind of ancestral, kind of purge in a certain way, and he had his own son. And he told me one day, he said, his son was like 3 or 4 months or something, and we were talking about like, what's it like, man, you're doing all this work, and now your son is here. And he said, I'll tell you, my mantra, basically. And he's like, it stops here. And that was it. Like it wasn't like he was obligated to somehow heal his own father, right? It was really just like, no, it just stops. Right? That's the precepts, right? He keeps his precepts, and again, the precepts are fairly direct. Don't hit the kid. Simple, right? You do that, the line stops. And if he's successful at that in subtle ways, because of course we know it's not, it's subtle, but to the degree that he's successful at that, his son won't carry it in the same way, right? And like you said, seven generations of non-fathers hitting their sons, and maybe it could be, we could say, healed or forgotten or, you know, resolved or integrated in the family system. And I would call that a kind of uprooting of hatred, right? So that's exactly the paradox of, like, here's my friend, an individual who needs to do his individual healing. And the paradox is, there's nothing individual about it, right? And it goes all the way out to, like, it's not even, you can look through any lens you want. You can be like, oh, this is a family process, you know? And then we can zoom way out and be like, my friend is trying to heal from patriarchy,
yeah.
You know? And wherever you go, whatever's your favorite layer to work on, right, which is probably like the one that stings the most or something, or the one that's most visible to you, that's where you do your work. You start there, you know. And I think mostly if we are sincere in our search, we'll end up having to do a bit of this work at each of the levels. You'll have to do some bodily work, you have to do some family work, you have to do some community layer work, you'll have to do some cultural layer work, and you'll have to do some kind of existential layer work, because the karma plays out differently in each of those levels, and you have a self at each of those levels that has to be dealt with. Yeah. The first thing you said is so mysterious, that piece where we could say that given all this, that if all this is this way, if it does work this way, there is this way that everything couldn't be otherwise than it is. And that becomes, talk about paradox, very mysterious, how that fits with action and your choices, your volition, still being, you know, absolutely the foundation of the path. So nothing could be otherwise, but my friend still has to make the choice and kind of, you know, plant his foot on the earth and say it stops here. And we could say he's choosing it or he's not choosing it, there's no him there. Whatever layer you decide to deconstruct that at, it still is the case that he has to feel like he's making that choice for it to happen. And somehow that's what karma is.
And I was talking just specifically about you.
Yeah.
So that birth trauma, which was a terribly painful thing for you to be carrying, is a gift to the world and to us.
You know,
so it's like there's a balance going on there too.
You know, the Buddha's mom died when he was 7 days old also. And quite a number of the great sages were orphans. And I will propose at a certain point that that attachment rupture, that early attachment rupture, is actually one of the supportive conditions for turning toward liberation practices, right?
If you're lucky.
Yeah,
which means if you have the right conditions to assemble why did I end up here and my sister, who was also adopted, not? In all sorts of ways. A very different life trajectory, you know? Similar conditions even, radically different. So that part is very mysterious. And that's a place where we could probably zoom out. I sort of land at the community level. Like, my family didn't really save me. It certainly didn't save her. But at the level of community, I stumbled out of a painful home and I found, you know, hippie dancers in San Francisco. I found a very, very wholesome scene. And they uplifted me. So that was my good fortune in a deep way. And that very much led to being.